Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And Dr. Italy with us this hour, and we're going to talk about Jesus. Just as I said, our topic was this hour, Jesus. In particular, what does history tell us about Jesus? And how can we get reliable information about Jesus from sources outside of the Christian tradition? And what do we make of the reliability of the sources within the Christian tradition? Of course, this is key. And there's lots of people who end their consideration of Christianity because somebody told them, well, there's no real evidence that Jesus even existed or something, and that ends the matter for them. Well, it shouldn't end the matter. There's plenty of evidence, and you could hardly find someone better than Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio to talk about it. You can find all of his material at dritaly.com, dritaly.com. He's the author of many books, but let me plug one of them. And I really do want to plug it because Jesus, the Way, the Truth, and the Life. He wrote this. He produced the study, the video that goes with it. It's something your family should own. I got it. And I love it. It's just a wonderful, mature, and very helpful consideration of Jesus and his surroundings and the evidence for him and all of that. So I hope you will take a look at that. You can find out all about it at dritaly.com. You can get your signed copy there. Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio, thank you for being with us to talk about Jesus today.
Hey, it is a pleasure to be with you, Cy. And I want to say that really, you know, the key is getting is a personal knowledge, an acquaintance of Jesus. And that is really what it's all about. But, you know, it's important to know some things about him. He entered into history. We Catholics believe that God, who's outside of history, enters into history and transforms it and changes people's lives and is still changing people's lives. So if the Word became flesh in history at a certain place in a certain time, there ought to be some historical facts that help us to ground our relationship with Jesus. So that's kind of what we want to talk about, not like facts are everything, you know, but they're really important. And the Catholic Church has always been really very respectful of what we can know through science and through the science of history.
888-318-7884, our number if you would like to call, if you'd like some help with the historical evidence for Jesus, 888-318-7884, whether you're Catholic or not, whether you're Christian or not, you're welcome to call with your question. So maybe you could review for us, Dr. D'Ambrosio, some of the evidence. I sometimes hear this, or somebody will post a comment to something we've done online or whatnot, and they'll say, you know, there's this maybe possibly this guy that lived named Jesus, and then over the years these myths built up around him, and it's like a game of telephone, and one person passed the story to another, and all this myth accrued, and so there's really not much we can know about this guy. All we have is the kind of the story that built up around him, and I think they sometimes conceive of this as happening over hundreds of years. As a matter of fact, I know they do. And they don't realize that's actually not what happened. So can you give us kind of a review of what the actual historical evidence for Jesus is?
Well, the first thing I just want to say is historical evidence for ancient figures has had problems. And I mean, you know, nobody really questions whether Alexander the Great existed or not. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just kind of accepted by everybody. But the fact of the matter is that the earliest sources, written sources we have for Alexander come from 400 to 500 years after he died. That's the earliest written evidence we have of Alexander. Wow. But that's the way it is in the ancient world. You know, there's a lot that's copied and then gets lost, but we have copies, we don't have originals, and those, you know, that's kind of the way it works. The first two great historians in the ancient world, Herodotus and Thucydides, they lived in the 5th century BC. That's 500 years before Jesus. The earliest copies we have of their work are from 900 AD. So like over 1,000 years after they wrote. Now, what's amazing is with the Gospels, they've been subjected to unbelievable scrutiny, the four Gospels, and also Paul. And Paul wrote about Jesus about probably 20, 25 years after the resurrection of Jesus. The Gospels come from the first century. All four Gospels, the consensus is they come from 65 A.D., which is like 35 years after the resurrection or so, to maybe 95. But the point is, the gap between Jesus actually walking through the streets of Galilee in Jerusalem, and the written records that we have and we can read now, it's very short for the ancient world, amazingly brief. So the written testimony of the Gospels, and we'll just start with those, the four different sources. There's a little bit of interdependence there, but there's not a lot between John's gospel and something like Mark. We know Luke had more sources than Mark had, different ones. Matthew had some different ones. We can tell all this, but you got four different sources agreeing on the basics. This is very strong evidence for what they agree upon when it comes to the basics of Jesus' life. Very strong.
888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. You know, you mentioned Alexander the Great, but this is not a person who lived like Jesus, however. I mean, I wonder how many common people who weren't a Roman senator or a general, we know anything about from the ancient world.
Yeah, it's a really good point, because these people, like the Caesars and Alexander, during their lifetime, they commanded armies and states, and so there were busts, statues made of them, and all that kind of thing. When it comes to a preacher, an amazing but humble person like Jesus of Nazareth. When I say humble, I'm just talking from a historical point of view of growing up in a town. You know, the town of Nazareth, Cy, honestly, from what we can tell through excavating Nazareth and pretty much all of first century Nazareth, is contained underneath the church, the present Basilica of the Annunciation, and its plaza. It's only a few acres. We're talking maybe 50 homes, maybe 300 to 500 people. That's how tiny Nazareth was. It's not even mentioned in the Old Testament. So from an obscure place like that, to have anything about anyone who lived there during that time is absolutely amazing.
Yeah,
absolutely amazing.
888-318-7884, the number. What does history tell us about Jesus? So are the historical sources outside of the Christian tradition, are they pretty solid? Are they disputed? I mean, I'm thinking of things like, well, for example, the identity of Pontius Pilate. Well, you could establish that quite well outside the sources, but what about the identity of Jesus? Are there things that tell us about Jesus outside the Gospels?
There are only two surviving sources outside the New Testament, but those sources are independent of the New Testament, and they're both from non-Christians. One is from a Jew named Josephus. Josephus was a priest, and in those days, a priest doesn't mean your occupation. It means you're born into the priestly family, so you officiate twice a year. When he wasn't officiating as priest, he actually, the rebel government of Jerusalem, after they rebelled against the Romans, made him governor of northern Israel or Galilee. So he directed the operations of resistance against the Romans, but he was captured by them. Amazingly, he survived capture. He ended up defecting to the Roman side, but he was a loyal Jew who just felt like the Jews shouldn't have rebelled. It was a big mistake, and it wasn't God, and God judged them, and God was with the emperor. And so he moved to Rome, and he wrote two big works, one about the antiquities of the Jews and the other about the war that destroyed the temple. But anyway, in the antiquities, this is right about 30 years No, I'm sorry. Let me take that back. About 60 years after the resurrection of Jesus, he's writing this, around 90 AD. And he basically has a passage where he refers to Jesus. He refers to him somewhere else as well. He actually refers to James, the quote unquote, the brother of the Lord, and his martyrdom. So, and he mentions the Nazarenes and the Christians there. So he mentions Christians twice, Jesus once. And what he says about Jesus was interpolated by a later Christian author. And what does that mean? It means somebody thought it would be a good idea to add a little bit more to his text and pass it off as him. And so for a long time, people said, this is a fake passage. No, the passage is genuine. It's just you can take out the interpolation. How can you do that? Because the guy used vocabulary that Josephus never uses and used distinctively Christian concepts. So we can kind of purify the text. But the text shows someone who loved the truth and worked wonders, did mighty deeds. And it also mentions he was crucified. He was accused by leading men of the Jews. And Pontius Pilate, one of our procurators, crucified him in Jerusalem. So basic things, his existence, the fact that he worked wonders, the fact that he loved truth, and that he was crucified, and his disciples were still loyal to him. He calls them the tribe of the Christians, which no Christian would ever say, by the way, you know, call Christians a tribe.
Right.
But anyway, the point is, this is a solid a bit of evidence of the existence of Jesus in the main lines of this story. Of course, he doesn't mention the resurrection, but he mentions Jesus as kind of like he's talking to Romans who know about philosophers and they're very sophisticated. And he talks about Jesus in a certain kind of way, as if he was a lover of truth, the philosopher, who, because like Socrates, was persecuted and crucified for the truth. That's kind of what we get from Josephus. And then later on, a Roman, Tacitus, writes about the Christian, about the fire in Rome. And he notes that Nero blamed the fire in Rome, the great fire that happened around 64 AD or so. He blames this on the Christians. And Tacitus again mentions that this pernicious superstition, so obviously he doesn't like the Christians, but this pernicious superstition goes back to a guy who was crucified under Pontius Pilate in Galilee. And unfortunately, this superstition made its way to Rome. But the point is, it's verification from a hostile source to a certain degree about Christians being blamed for something they really didn't do, but you know, being members of this superstitious group that goes back to Jerusalem and Pontius Pilate's time. Now, the funny thing is, Pontius Pilate's a pretty obscure figure. He's not a big, important person. He is a second-class noble, a knight, not a senator type of dude. And the Jews hated him. And so he ends up getting kicked out and kind of fades into history about 5 years after the resurrection. So he's not a big figure. The fact that he's mentioned by both these people and connected with Jesus' death is significant.
888-318-7884, 888-31-TRUTH. What does history tell us about Jesus? Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio, our guest, you can find him at dritaly.com. We'll take a quick break and we'll come back with some of your calls. And I also want to ask you, Dr. D'Ambrosio, about just the general, like when the Gospels, for example, report on maybe get, you know, little details like the name of the high priest or the this or that, how do they do as far as history when they're not talking about Jesus? Like, do they get the setting and the personalities right and give us reason to trust them otherwise? We'll talk about that and take your calls for Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Catholic Answers Focus is gluten-free and delicious. Get it at CatholicAnswersFocus.com. A new survey says only 48% of Americans, only 48% of Americans believe Jesus is God. We've got to work on that. And so we had Carlo come in for a bonus episode to talk about having confidence that Jesus is God. Also, if you're having trouble praying, Monday's episode is for you. Father Hugh Barber explains why including God in the things you're already doing can turn your life into a life of prayer. And then on Wednesday's episode, do you want to know your true identity, then you're going to have to listen to your Creator. The good news is he's always willing to talk so you can get to know Jesus and he will help you get to know yourself. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. Catholic Answers Focus is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or anywhere else probably, or you can find it online on YouTube or at CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Prayer doesn't have to be anything rigid or formal. Of course, we have countless ones we can turn to when words don't come to mind. So rote prayers are fantastic, but I also like to pray by listening to praise music, reading the Psalms, and just listening to God's voice. Keep in mind that prayer is a two-way endeavor. Sometimes we think it's just us talking and God listening. If that's what your prayer life has mainly consisted of, try getting used to listening to God speak to you. You'll hear beautiful and amazing things.
I think it's fair to say about the Christian faith, about the Catholic practice of the Christian faith, that if you go very far wrong on Jesus, it gets out of focus, and your faith is greatly distorted because he's the center, the source of it all. And so we have Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio, Dr. Italy here to talk with us about Jesus today and what history teaches us about Jesus. I do want to recommend again to you the whole set of the book and the DVD and the study guide, Jesus, the Way, the Truth, and the Life, that Dr. D'Ambrosio made. It's really something worth maybe watching with the kids or having in your home to draw closer to the person of Jesus, who's the center of it all, the most important part of all of it. But also, Dr. D'Ambrosio, I want to mention this before I go to calls, and then I promise those on the phone, because there's quite a few on the phone, will go right to calls. I said to you before we did the show, well, you're not doing any pilgrimages. And you said, oh, yes, I am. And so in April, you're going to do a pilgrimage walking in the footsteps of Jesus. I assume that will not be in England or Japan. That will probably be in the Holy Land.
Yes, indeed. Jerusalem, Galilee, Bethlehem. Yes, we're doing it all. And I'm sure we'll all be in great shape by then. This whole first thing far behind us. And we'll be, so we're looking forward to it. We're absolutely looking forward. And we got a lot of people already who are coming. So we'd love to have more Catholic Answers listeners come with us. So go to dritaly.com if you'd like to come, and you'll be glad you did.
You will be glad you did. Let's go to Bob in Houston, Texas, listening on 1430 AM. Bob, thank you for your patience. Your question for Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm the caller. Didn't know if I was in the right place or not, but maybe you can help me out. I'm trying to figure out, it's D-I-D-A-C-H-E, Didache, or?
Oh, Didache, the Didache.
There you go. Can you tell me what that is or what it's all about?
I would love to. You know what? I wrote a book that has a Didache in it, as a matter of fact, or a review of it and the story of it. It's called When the Church Was Young, Voices of the Early Fathers. So the Didache, the name of it really, that Didache just means teaching in Greek. And so the title of it is The Teaching of the 12 Apostles. And it is a document that was lost for a long time, and really only discovered and fully identified, rediscovered, identified around 1890s. So it caused a sensation when it was discovered. And as scholars have pored over it, it really seems to be a compilation of two documents, most probably from the first century. So one of them is the first, probably the earliest Christian catechism. It uses the Ten Commandments to help people get ready to get baptized and follow Jesus. And then the second part is actually a description of worship life in the early church. How do you baptize, right? What is the Lord's Supper supposed to be like? So it's pretty amazing little document, a very short, very easy to read. You can find it online. You can get a little review of it with some salient points from my book, When the Church Was Young. But it really is a precious treasure. And, it probably was stitched together, we think, but around 125 AD is the best date for when it was stitched together. But the two documents come from first century. So they're probably, from around the same time as the Gospels that we have in the New Testament.
So it's a precious little document, a precious little window into the life of the earliest Christians.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. So what do you think about that, Bob?
I think it's great. But really not any authoritative thing, but just kind of something that was found later, I guess.
Well, let's put it this way. It's not inspired. The church doesn't regard it as inspired scripture, but it is basically regarded as one of the apostolic fathers. We don't know who wrote it. The man wasn't concerned about himself and taking credit. He saw this as the teaching of the 12 apostles, and that's all he cared about, is passing on the tradition. But it's a precious witness to the apostolic tradition. So it is authoritative, but not like Scripture. It's secondary sort of authority.
But very, very profitable to read, Bob. Thanks for your question.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio, our guest, we're talking about what does history tell us about Jesus? If you have a question in that regard, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. I haven't forgotten my question, but I do want to just keep getting to callers for a minute. But I said I was going to ask you that question about how historically reliable are the Gospels in other ways, which maybe can help us get a sense of how historically reliable they are in general. But let's go to anonymous caller first. And anonymous, your question for Dr. D'Ambrosio.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. Okay, so thanks for taking my call. So how do we know that and how the 12 apostles were martyred?
Okay, good question. We actually only know with good historical records from the first century, we only know really about the martyrdom of a very few. We really know about James. That's told, James, son of Zebedee, was the first to die probably around 44 AD, and that's told to us in the book of Acts. And then we know from Josephus that the brother of the Lord, so to speak, that's the title given him, he's a kinsman of the Lord, James, who's also mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles. We really know from Josephus about his martyrdom, probably around 60 AD or so. And then Peter and Paul, we basically know, it's not from the New Testament itself, but we know pretty strongly from other Christian tradition that goes back to the first and second century, that Peter and Paul died in Rome. But as far as the other apostles go, there are lots of stories that are traditional, but we just don't have first century data. We don't have like written sources close to the time, like the story about St. Thomas going to India. That's very strong in the Indian community. I don't doubt it, but we just don't have, as a historian, I wouldn't have like good first century data that shows that. So there's actually a lot of books out there that try to trace the various stories of other apostles, but they kind of disappear. You know, there's not a lot in the New Testament about many of the 12 after the ministry of Jesus. We just don't see a lot of clear evidence there. Does that help?
Okay, so yes, it does. So, but what if someone like denies like the New Testament, right? So they'll deny the martyrdom of I forgot who he said was
James?
Was martyred, but yes, James. So like what like is there? What would you say to them then?
Well, I would just say, well, why would you deny the New Testament historically? A lot of secular historians think that the New Testament is a very, very valuable source for info, even info beyond info about Jesus. For example, history of first century Judaism, New Testament, some of our best written sources. There's not a lot of other first century documents that tell us about Jewish life in the time of Jesus. And so Jewish historians pore over the New Testament, and they think that there's a whole lot of reliable info there. So there's not a lot of that. You know, you can be skeptical, but there's not a lot of grounds for serious skepticism about the New Testament as historical documents. That was kind of the point we were making earlier. You know, in terms of ancient sources, there's no other, number. Like the New Testament has 5,600 manuscripts that of New Testament writings that go back some as early as the second century. And like, we don't have anything like that for Homer. I mean, we only have like 800 manuscripts of Homer from that era. So like the New Testament, the number of manuscripts is just unbelievable. The closeness to when they were written, the fact that we have multiple sources within the New Testament that agree on basics. These are the kinds of things that make historians say, well, I'm not a Christian. I don't necessarily believe Jesus is God, but you know, the New Testament books are serious historical documents that give us a good amount of info. So that's what I would say. Yeah, there's no rational grounds just dismissing the New Testament just because you may not be a Christian and don't think it's inspired.
Anonymous caller, thanks. And that actually leads into what I wanted to ask Dr. D'Ambrosio about. And by the way, more callers are welcome. If you like, we will have room to get to you in the second half of the show, 888-318-7884. 888-318-7884 if you want to talk about what history says about Jesus. So if I'm looking at the Gospels and I want to say, okay, what kind of reliability can I give them? I want to test them against what I know. Otherwise, you know, about the ancient world, are they pretty good? Like, do they get the names and the dates right? How are they as historical documents other than what they have to say about Jesus?
Yeah, I'll just give you one little example of something corroborated by discoveries. John is the only one who tells us about the paralytic who gets healed in Jerusalem at this place called Bethesda, where there are five porticos and two big pools. And there was no evidence of that in other writings. Like, you know, there's not so much of Jewish writing was destroyed in the first century. So,
oh, this is going to have to be a cliffhanger. I'm sorry, this is going to have to be a cliffhanger because the music's playing. Oh, this is good. We got a cliffhanger.
All right.
So John tells us about the place with five porticos and this pool in Bethesda. And we will find out the rest of that story as Paul Harvey would say, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Give us a call today on Catholic Answers Live.
If you spend any time on Twitter, Facebook, or mainstream media, you're probably familiar with the litany of slogans that skeptics employ to rescue you from the foolish belief that God exists. The constant onslaught seems to leave people with the idea that they have no alternative but to embrace atheism. How can a Christian respond? In One Less God Than You, John DeRosa breaks down 20 of the most common atheist challenges and shows you how to craft effective answers. Atheism is more aggressive and widespread than ever. Read One Less God Than You and prepare yourself to respond with the joyful truth that God is real. To get your copy of One Less God Than You, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Many Catholics ignore the Bible. They say they have the Church instead. But we should embrace sacred scripture, not just as the revealed Word of God, but as a Catholic work, intimately connected with the Church from the earliest centuries. In The Bible is a Catholic Book, apologist Jimmy Akin shows how the Bible cannot exist apart from the Church, in its origins, in the truths it contains, in its careful preservation over the centuries. Scripture is inseparable from the Catholic faith. This is fitting, since both come from God for our salvation. If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. After all, Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 1-844-239-4952, visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Legal marijuana is all the rage in some parts of the country, either for medicinal or recreational use.
Is that a positive thing for our culture?
That's our topic on the next Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
Now more of Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Our guest is Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio. Dr. Italy, you can find him at dritaly.com. You can find all about his various work that he does, including with the Crossroads Initiative. And you can probably, I would suggest you look into Jesus, the way, the truth, and the life, and see if that's something you want to invest in for your family. Today, we're talking about Jesus. As a matter of fact, we're talking about what history can tell us about Jesus. And so my question to Dr. D'Ambrosio, and I'm really looking forward to the payoff on this, was about, well, how do the Gospels do as far as getting the time and place of Jesus right? Like, do they get the names of we know they got the name of Pontius Pilate right, but I mean, of the details, how good are the details as far as the time and place of Jesus? Because that would give us some hint about how reliable they are in general as historical documents. And Dr. D'Ambrosio started to tell us the story about the fifth chapter of John's Gospel that talks about a pool called Bethesda in Jerusalem with five porticos. So that's in John's Gospel. And then you wanted to kind of finish that for us.
Yeah. In the 19th century, the first historical critical Bible scholars were very skeptical about the historical reliability of things like this. So they thought John's really symbolic, and five porticos symbolized the law. So he kind of created this place and created this story. And then in the 20th century, people started digging a little bit more in Jerusalem. And lo and behold, we found these massive pools that had been surrounded by the five porticos. And we found that not only Jews, but pagans, after the Jerusalem was turned into a pagan city, they continued to bathe in these pools seeking healing. They made shrines to the Greek god of healing in these pools. So anyway, the point is, there's amazing bits of historical data that's not the intent of the four evangelists. They want us to get to know Jesus. But on the side, they're revealing all sorts of bits and pieces of life in the time of Jesus that are very reliable.
Yes. I love that this is something that was lost. So it was lost for long enough that people just kind of, oh, John's not real history, and this is all symbolic. And they start giving symbolic explanations. And all it was John was telling the truth about what Jerusalem looked like, a truth that was subsequently forgotten.
Absolutely.
Which is wonderful testimony to the Gospels. If you have questions about what history teaches us about Jesus, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884. We go now to Tony in Dayton, Ohio, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Tony, your question for Dr. D'Ambrosio.
Yes. I guess I remember learning way back when this, and I'm just wanting to learn some verification or whatnot. Did the Romans officially record Jesus's death, Jesus's crucifixion? Is there like a log somewhere that says, on this day or this year, you know, we killed Jesus and two other guys, or however they would have done that? Is that something that is in a matter of record?
Well, there's a lot of things like that most probably were written down by the Romans, but we don't have them. So when you think about the fact that Jerusalem was destroyed and the town of Caesarea where Pilate lived was destroyed, you know, there's tons of historical documents that are lost. So we're dealing really, you know, we'd be grateful if we had more info from the Roman period like that, official Roman government documents. But very, very few exist, not just about Jesus, but about anything, really.
Okay, Tony?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. So no is the answer.
Yeah. Indeed. Indeed. But we were just talking about this at the break, that the idea that really we, even though we might sometimes kind of roll our eyes at the skepticism of some modernist biblical scholars or historians or archaeologists but they have done a great service over the last 150 years of uncovering the Holy Land in a way that can make us see the story of Jesus much more clearly, and also judge the Gospels and those things much more clearly about what their meaning was and how they fit into history. And even just finding things like, you know, Pontius Pilate's name chiseled into rocks, you know, it gives you a sense of this was a real thing that happened in real history among real people that really lived, and it's pretty darn good at remembering those things.
Absolutely. It's one of the reasons why I'm so addicted to bringing people to the Holy Land and going on pilgrimage there, because it really does bring home the reality and the earthiness of Jesus, Mary, Joseph, the apostles, these places, you know, it really, really helps a lot.
Again, 888-318-7884 is our number. Okay, that's a good plug. So you're going back there in April. So go to dritaly.com to find out how
that's
you can
right.
go. But yeah. You can also just see it on the videos too that you made. You're in the actual places, which
absolutely
is very, very helpful. But there is modern scholarship, it's very funny, even in trying to disprove Jesus sometimes, keeps uncovering things that give us greater confidence in the historicity of Jesus and the accuracy of those who wrote about him.
Absolutely. And so a lot of people have heard about the Dead Sea Scrolls. The Dead Sea Scrolls don't tell us anything about the person of Jesus directly, but they really help us understand a whole lot about what Jesus was up against in the Pharisees. The Pharisees were somewhat like the Dead Sea Scroll folks in terms of their attitude towards sinners being beyond hope. But also, you know, the importance of daily repentance and prayer. Their whole life, they kept a library there that helped us understand the time of Jesus and Judaism, the time of Jesus. And it really helps us realize it so much that people had thought was in the New Testament was kind of like, you know, from Greek mystery religions or something. It really was so Jewish.
Yeah.
How Jewish Jesus was, how Jewish the apostles were, Jesus teaching. You know, it's kind of amazing how discoveries like that help us put flesh and bones on the whole story of the Gospels.
Tony, thanks again for your call. I hope that more will be discovered. So we have that anticipation of what the archaeologists and historians will discover. Let's go to Harry in Portland, Oregon, listening on a Google Home. I don't even know how you do that, Harry, but you must be very advanced, Harry. Your question,
gentlemen, and thank you for taking my call.
Happy to do it.
Yeah, the question I have is the description of Jesus. As you know, majority of the icons of Jesus, he looks a certain way. And I remember years ago, I was reading about someone who actually witnessed and saw Jesus and wrote down what he saw. And I remember, the only thing I remember about it was he had strong arms that were lovely to touch. I kind of remember that part, but do you know any reason why? I mean, anyway, about the description of Jesus.
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you this. The four authors of the Gospels did not care at all to give us details like that, which we would love to know, you know?
Yeah.
But they don't. And the reason is because they're really preoccupied with us getting to know what he's like. And what difference he makes in our lives, not so much some of these biographical details that are interesting. But I will tell you this, there's no absolute proof that the Shroud of Turin is Jesus' burial shroud. But I think the evidence is very, very strong, despite a carbon-14 test that was faulty, honestly, and has been shown to be such. But anyway, I think it's rather overwhelming. If you go to Jerusalem, and you visit, there's a special shroud exhibit, and it's at the Pontifical Notre Dame Institute, where I stay with my pilgrims. But anyway, this exhibit has 3D study. The image on the shroud is a 3D image, and the man of the shroud can be reconstructed in terms of a sculpture. So there's this bronze sculpture that is based on the shroud that's there, and it is really very, very profoundly moving of you know, this dead man who's there. And you can see how rugged he is. And you have to understand, those guys walked 100 miles back and forth from Jerusalem to Galilee. It was 100 miles, over 100 miles from Capernaum to Jerusalem. And they did that three times a year for probably three times minimum. And at least in one case, four, based on John's gospel. They were all over the country in blazing heat, and walking to Jerusalem from Galilee means generally walking from Jericho uphill, and you're going from 900, 800 feet below sea level to 2,500 feet above sea level, and you're walking uphill through a desert. I mean, it's unbelievable. So it's a rugged person who emerges from the shroud. They had to be rugged. They were not wimpy kinds of guys, you know. They were tough dudes. And actually, just so you know, carpenter is what we typically translate Jesus' profession and Joseph's profession as. But really, the word is builder. There's a Greek word, tekton, which comes from technology, and it involved also masonry. So we're talking about guys who were dealing with big pieces, not just fine carpentry, but big construction, you know? So they are rugged Jesus was rugged, and those guys who were fishermen were rugged. That's one thing we can tell you about them, for sure.
Thanks, Harry. I'm going to leave it there because there are lots of folks who want to talk to Dr. D'Ambrosio, and I have to take one more quick break, and then we'll be back to do those calls. Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio is our guest. We're talking about Jesus in history. What can history tell us about Jesus? More of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
There's only one. Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
St. Paul's street evangelization isn't like other evangelism you might have seen on the streets. We don't yell, and we don't force anyone to pay attention to us. Instead, St. Paul's street evangelization is committed to presenting a positive, passionately Catholic presence to a world hungry for truth. For more information, or to start a chapter of your own, go to www.streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com. It's time to do our part.
Hey Alexa, how many ways can I get EWTN?
You can get EWTN on television, via cable and satellite, on Apple TV, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Google Play. You can get EWTN radio in your car, on Sirius XM Channel 130, and on the go, on any mobile device with the EWTN app. And here's the best news. Now you can get EWTN's great programming on me.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We're talking about the historical evidence for Jesus. Jesus, in both the historical evidence provided in the New Testament, in Christian tradition, and from all those sources that come from outside of Christian tradition. We go now to Carl in Dallas, Texas, with a question. Carl, listening on Guadalupe Radio there in Dallas, Texas. A question for Marcellino D'Ambrosio, our guest. Your question for Dr. D'Ambrosio, Carl.
Dr. D'Ambrosio, there was a theory floated in the 1970s in popular media. I'm not sure how much serious scholarship, but that the idea of the Lord and the Catholic Church was actually invented sometime after Constantine and was used as material basically for their own purposes of the Christians at that time or even of the state. How would you counter that basic theme?
Okay, let me just ask this question. It's really an old, it's kind of old school that people blame, the Catholic Church for making a lot of stuff up after Constantine or at the time of Constantine. But that they made up Jesus or they made up the Catholic Church? I just didn't get that.
Well, that they basically used the biographical, prophecy of the Lord or his basic existence, but then they created much more of it for their own purposes than was actually there at the beginning.
Well, it's actually really easy to debunk that now. It was a lot harder to debunk that. It was harder back in the time of the Reformation because we didn't have a lot of the sources that we have now. But we have things like the Didache that we mentioned earlier in this show. And we also have a lot from the 2nd century and the 3rd century that we didn't have. The documents weren't, we didn't have them. And so we actually see that so many things that people thought were made up by the Catholic Church after Constantine, like the Trinity or devotion to Mary or sacramental life, all those things can be clearly documented. Belief in the divinity of Jesus and all that stuff. At the beginning of the 2nd century, middle 2nd century, 3rd century, way before Constantine. So I just recommend, there's a book that I wrote called When the Church Was Young, Voices of the Early Fathers, and it just kind of lays out what we know now from the fathers of the church about so much that what the early church really was like, even before Constantine, before the government got involved. So anyway, I think it's important to just look at those documents. It's not a matter of opinion anymore. We actually have proof of what early Christianity was like in the 2nd and 3rd century.
Carl, thank you very much for that question. Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio is our guest. Your questions welcome at 888-31-TRUTH. We're talking about the historical evidence for Jesus today. We're going out to Peter in Port Charlotte, Florida, also listening on Guadalupe Radio. Peter, your question for Dr. D'Ambrosio.
Hi. Another thing that happened in the 1890s, that you said the DK got discovered. I'm not clear on the details, but in the 1890s, also corroborating extra-biblical evidence for one of Nebuchadnezzar's sons was, or Daniel or Nebuchadnezzar, was discovered, and it proved the Bible right. It was almost as if in the 1890s and for the next 50 years, God thought that modern man needed some kind of extra, a little extra proof, a little extra intrigue, to wake them up out of their fundamentalist scientism that's creeping up.
What do you think about that, Dr. D'Ambrosio?
I think that's great. I don't know exactly the bit of data that you're referring to when it comes to Nebuchadnezzar and one of his sons. But the point is, I do think that we're really blessed to live in this age, and that science is doing nothing really good science. I mean, there's a lot of bad science. I think we've learned that not all scientists are scientific. I think what the COVID experience is one of the things hopefully we take away from this. You don't just trust somebody because they got a PhD. You got to look at their data, look at their argument. And the nice thing about science and history is over time, people will question earlier findings, and a lot of times you generally will sift and things get clearer. But honestly, when you come right down to it, everything that's been discovered documentary-wise, archaeological-wise, helps, generally speaking, to corroborate the historical reliability of the Old and the New Testament. So that's really cool.
What do you think, Peter?
Yeah, it's exciting.
Yeah. About the King David stele? That's one of my favorites, the one that mentions King David. Because David's another one where, well, he was probably nothing and not much of an anything, and maybe they made up this guy David and all this. And then you find an ancient stone carving with his name in it, referring to his people. So I find that really very, very cool. I mean, I suppose, in some ways, it's people who think, well, what you imagine, King David's kingdom was like is not what it was like. It's okay. I'm willing to go, yeah, you're probably right about that. My imagination is not what the thing was like.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it wasn't there, or that David wasn't
exactly
a real historical person.
Absolutely. And the more you learn, the better your imagination gets.
Yeah.
It gets corrected, and that's one of the things that the book that I wrote on Jesus, it really will help people's imagination and just kind of rethinking everything,
right,
down to Joseph and Mary and Nazareth and that all those things. And there's a lot that we can know that we didn't think we could know, even about Jesus' hidden years in Nazareth. There's a lot more we can say about what was going on there and what it was like. So I think it's really cool.
Yeah. Has archaeology also given us, because you described the town of Nazareth where Jesus lived as it couldn't probably be more than 350 people or something. But what about the wider area of the Galilee, around Nazareth? So we have a better sense from archaeology of just kind of like what his community, what his milieu was like, not just the town
itself,
but we have.
So the whole milieu. Just a little while ago, people that I know, a priest who's in charge of hospitality for the Vatican, was looking at a site in near where the town of Magdala was probably, and he bought this piece of land, and they start working on it to build a hotel and basically a retreat center, and boom, they hit something. Well, it was the ancient town of Magdala was found, and it's only been excavated now for a few years. They're still working on it. They only have 10% of it excavated, but they have a first century synagogue in which Jesus almost certainly taught.
Wow.
And, the town of Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
Amazing. I mean, just absolutely, absolutely amazing. And fish tanks. It was a big town for fish processing, and they actually shipped fish pickled, you know, like pickled fish, preserved fish to Rome out of Magdala. So the apostles certainly would have brought catches there and sold it on the docks. And so we're standing there and we're seeing this piece of history emerging. And again, this is another example of something that's really recent. It was, I think it was 2009 that it was first hit, and it's still being discovered. We're actually going to stay there because they finished, they had to reposition the buildings, you know, to avoid building on top of and destroying the city. But anyway, we're going to be staying right on that site, which is pretty cool.
That is so cool. So then what do we know about these? Like, if Jesus walked into a synagogue, was he walking into a building like we would think of a modern church? Was it a small, like how many people would have been, you know, there to hear him say in the synagogue in Magdala?
This was a small synagogue. You might get 100 people in there in the main room. Yeah. Uh-huh. So, and we get an idea. You know, we think synagogue is a church where you do a lot of worship, and there was prayer there, but it was mainly a gathering place for study. So there's a lot of study going on there. It was kind of a community center. And, you know, it wasn't a sacred place in the way we think of a church with a tabernacle and a blessed sacrament.
Right.
It was all pointed to Jerusalem, and actually the earliest stone representation that was made of certain things, like the candelabra, the seven branch candelabra that was in the temple, is on this special stone that's found at Magdala. It's the earliest representation in stone of what the temple looked like, you know, some of the art of things in the temple. Really awesome stuff, you know. But again, like, this is just 2009 is when it started to be dug, and it's only 10% excavated. Isn't that crazy?
It's crazy and wonderful.
So there's so much more. There's so much more to learn and to find. And by the way, people can go to Magdala and actually work as volunteers in the excavations if they like.
Let's go to Julie in Colorado. As soon as you start talking about volunteering, I got to move on. listening to EWTN Channel 130 on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Hi, Julie. Your question for Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio.
Yeah, my question is, I was visiting with someone and they more or less claimed, well, pretty much flat out claimed that the New Testament was all made up to just support what the Old Testament had been written in the Old Testament. And obviously you're providing great evidence that that's not true, but I'm wondering, is there a book or something that I could get for this person to kind of help them start seeing differently than what they've been taught somewhere in college?
College.
Sure. Well, college, you know, you can have good professors and you can have pretty bad professors. You know? So anyway, let me just say this, Julie. The book that we're talking about, Jesus, the Way, the Truth, and the Life, it shows that you can't just explain Jesus as an add-on to the Old Testament. There's a principle in history called the principle of discontinuity. When things are just exactly the way everyone expects, you think, you know, from that era, you think stuff can get made up. You know, someone can create a figure. You know, it doesn't take much imagination if you know the era just to make up another figure who fits in the era. Jesus is very unusual because he's so Jewish, but he is so discontinuous. He's radical, and that's why he was crucified. He did things that didn't fit with the common culture when it comes to the way you think God wants you to live. You know, I think Jesus' interpretation of the Old Testament is better than his contemporaries, and it's because he happens to be the Word made flesh. But the point is, he was so different than I was just talking to Cy during the break on divorce. Just the idea of the indissolubility of marriage was not something you find in the book in Deuteronomy or in current Jewish culture. The prevailing rabbinical interpretation at the time of Jesus, Hillel, he basically said, you could give your wife a bill of divorce if you find anything unpleasing in her, including if she burnt your dinner. Now, Jesus's attitude is like completely different. And he got flack for his ideas on marriage, on the indissolubility of marriage. He's still getting flack for it. But you can't explain Jesus just in terms of he was just a typical Jew of his time. You know, the New Testament is different. Huh?
Yeah, that's very Julie, what do you make of that?
That's perfect. So I'll look for your book.
Awesome.
Yeah,
awesome.
You should. You know what? If Julie will hang on the line, can we send her Jimmy's CD of You Can Why You Can Trust the Gospels too? Because it's a good one to, or the DVD. Holy smokes, the music already. Julie, thanks for that call. Dr. Marcellino D'Ambrosio, our guest. I got about a million more questions for him. Love talking about Jesus. And you know what? I love talking about Jesus, and I love the way you talk about Jesus. You always put us back in the right perspective on Jesus as the center of it all, who wants to be in a loving relationship with us, who wants to know us and wants us to know him.
And there's nothing that's worth more than knowing him.
There's nothing indeed. Find out about what Dr. D'Ambrosio does, and maybe you want to go walk in the footsteps of Jesus, even stand in the synagogue where Jesus himself taught in the town of Magdala. You can find out all about that at dritaly.com. That's dritaly.com. Dr. D'Ambrosio, thank you again.
You're most welcome. My pleasure.
We'll see you tomorrow for Open Forum, God willing, right here.